You're listening to Beyond Bourbon Street, an insider's guide to New Orleans. Beyond Bourbon Street is the podcast where we explore the food, music, culture, places, and people that make New Orleans unique. Whether you are planning a trip, living in New Orleans, or simply wanting a taste of the Crescent City from wherever you are, you've come to the right place. And now, your host, Mark Bologna.
Hey y'all, this is Mark. Welcome to episode 56. The last one was the second in a three-part series we're doing about Louisiana plantations. The first of that series was all about Whitney Plantation and the lives of the enslaved. In the most recent episode, we took you along River Road between New Orleans and Baton Rouge, and we discussed the 12 plantations along that way that are open to the public. We gave you some pointers on how you might approach that trip, depending on the amount of time you have to explore and what you hope to get out of your visit along the river. If you missed either of those last two episodes, go back and give them a listen. The response to both has been great, and I think you'll appreciate them too. Today's show is going to be all about Mardi Gras. We're recording in January 2018 in the midst of carnival season here in New Orleans, so it seemed appropriate to do an episode about Mardi Gras. This one is going to tackle Mardi Gras and carnival history with a twist. We're going to address the age-old question of who invented Mardi Gras. To do this, we're going to learn all about the city of Mobile and their Mardi Gras celebrations and history. As you'll learn, Mobile and New Orleans have a lot in common. Before we jump in, though, I want to say a quick thanks to Liz Marty Cook at Lionheart Prints. You might remember Liz from episode 51. That was a show where we featured three New Orleans business owners, Liz, Kristen from Home Malone, and Patty over at Chop Industries. In any event, Liz was kind enough to offer up her space as a place where we could record today's show. If you headed to New Orleans for Mardi Gras, for French Quarter Fest, or Jazz Fest, be sure to stop in and check out Lionheart. It's on Magazine Street, just off Louisiana Avenue, and it's clustered among a great group of stores. You'll find beautiful hand-lettered cards and prints, one-of-a-kind offerings by local artists, cool t-shirts, and a whole lot more. I love my Who's Your Crawdaddy t-shirt and plan on wearing it on my upcoming journey aboard the Rockboat Cruise with Sister Hazel and Cowboy Mouth, but I digress. Come check out Lionheart Prints and say hi to Liz and the gang over here. Be sure to use offer code BEYONDBOURBON, all one word, to get $5 off any t-shirt when you shop online or when you visit Liz in-store. With that, let's jump in. As I mentioned, today we're going to learn about the history of Mardi Gras and specifically about the tie between New Orleans and Mobile. To help us, I solicited a guest who lives in Mobile but has deep roots in New Orleans. In fact, he's a seventh-generation New Orleanian, though he found love and home a bit further along the Gulf Coast over in Mobile. He's become ingrained in that city's carnival culture and traditions and is a great fit for today's topic. Welcome to the show, Mr. Ted Flott. How are you?
Good. Thank you, Mark. I appreciate you letting me address such a controversial and touchy topic, so I appreciate you, your courage there.
Yeah, you know, it's always a bit when we decide to dive into some of the sacred things about New Orleans. You never know how that's going to go.
Well, we'll try not to make too many people upset.
So first, you know, when you reached out to me, Ted said, hey, you know, I am from New Orleans and I live in Mobile and this might be a fun topic. And we have a Facebook group over, the easiest way to get there is beyondbourbonst.com/Facebook, where we kind of exchange ideas and people looking to come to New Orleans or share memories or looking for advice. And people have been talking about Mobile. And so then when you reached out, it was sort of like, yeah, maybe this is karma. We should tackle it. But before we get there, so you grew up here in the city in New Orleans, is that right?
Yeah, I did. I was born here, and it's kind of a trope, but seventh generation New Orleanian. It's somewhat tongue-in-cheek, but it tells you that you know, my family got here. They were refugees from the Haitian Revolution. There was a large amount of French-speaking people that came through Cuba to New Orleans around 1810. And they lived over in the lower French Quarter and along Esplanade Avenue and then in the Marigny, and eventually made their way uptown. And so I grew up there. And then in the 1990s, there was kind of a economic depression. My family ended up moving to the beach in Alabama in Fort Morgan. I met a girl from Mobile there. After school, we lived in Birmingham and Jackson, Mississippi, and Seattle and London. But we always wanted to make it back to the Gulf Coast, and so we ended up in Mobile.
Well, neat, and I think it's interesting that as we're going to get into Mobile and New Orleans have a lot in common, really going back to the founding of each place. But it's interesting to see how carnival developed, and again, we're going to get into who started it and what that might mean. but there's a lot of tie-in, so I'm anxious to jump into it. How did you get into it? Was your family involved in carnival when you lived here in New Orleans?
They were. They were to different degrees. I was able to ride on a school truck float, as our sure. school did, and I actually was in one of the courts, and then when I was a senior in high school, my dad got sick and couldn't ride, and so I had to, after talking to the people on either side of him, I was able to sneak on and take his place. Then after I went to college, they moved, essentially stopped participating at that point. Again, when we moved back to Mobile, jumped right back into it.
Neat. Well, let's talk a little bit about Mobile for people that maybe don't know where it is. Let's talk about where Mobile is geographically relative to New Orleans.
Yeah, it's about 2 hours east, straight down I-10. I left my house and was here within 2 hours, and so it's a, you know, in some places that's a daily commute, but we come for the day for Jazz Fest or what have you, or just on random weekdays come over and eat and shop and head back. So it's really an easy trip.
Yeah, and we were talking before we turned on the recorder that if you live in New Orleans, often you go through Mobile on the way to the beach over in Florida usually. But or if you're coming to visit New Orleans, one of the things I hope to leave the listeners with today is an appreciation for all that Mobile has. Certainly, we're going to focus on Carnival and Mardi Gras today. But it's a good place to stop, whether you spend an afternoon and have lunch or spend a night and maybe wander around a little bit. One of the things that is a tie-in that maybe people don't realize about Mobile is that Mobile, like New Orleans, was founded by Bienville.
Yeah, that's right. You know, when the Spanish started to put their hands on the Gulf Coast at Pensacola, the French sent La Salle down the Mississippi, and then Iberville came on the Gulf Coast. They stopped at Dauphin Island, and they stopped at what they named the Pont du Mardi Gras in 1699, which was in Plaquemines Parish, about 60 miles south of New Orleans, and so that's where one of the claims of the first Mardi Gras come from. Then they turned around. They for about 2 years, they were at what's called Old Biloxi near Ocean Springs, Mississippi, and then they sent a party to scout the Mobile River, and they met some a friendly tribe of Indians called the Mavilla or Mobilia Indians, and they settled next to them. They were able to survive with their help, and they intermarried with them. And then in 1711, they moved down to the current site of Mobile for a little bit better conditions for trade and shipping.
So, and early on, Mobile was, I think, the original capital of the Louisiana Territory. Is that right?
Yeah, most people don't realize it was the original capital. You know, in that day, obviously, there's no interstates, so the main trade, actually went from, you know, between New Orleans and Mobile a lot. So they were both in French Louisiana until the French and Indian War in 1763. At that point, New Orleans became Spanish, and Mobile became British in British West Florida. And remained that until the Revolutionary War. The Spanish Galvez came over from New Orleans, conquered Mobile. So that's the first time New Orleans conquered Mobile. And then, so Mobile was Spanish. After Louisiana Purchase, there was actually an attempted independent republic of West Florida by some people out of Baton Rouge. They tried to take Mobile from the Spanish. They couldn't, but then the Americans, General Wilkinson, came from New Orleans once again and conquered Mobile, and so Mobile came American at that point, and then became a state in 1819. But their histories have really been intertwined since the very beginning.
Longtime listeners will remember a couple episodes back we interviewed geographer Richard Campanella, and he has a book called Bienville's Dilemma. And we're recording this in 2018, so we're celebrating the tricentennial, the 300th anniversary of the founding of New Orleans, and he talks in his book, and we talked about in that episode, about the first dilemma of Bienville in terms of where should they found. And originally they saw Mobile as the hub because of the access to the Gulf of Mexico. They ultimately moved further into what is now New Orleans so that they could protect and really defend against the British trying to encroach on getting into the interior of what became the United States through the river. And so that played a big part. In that sense, Mobile lost out a little bit retrospectively, right, because of defending the port. But Mobile and the port there in the Gulf is a big port unto itself, you know, with the access, not necessarily to the interior, but certainly to the Gulf and out into the world.
Yeah, I mean, Mobile's always been a little bit smaller. The catchment, you know, area for Mobile is basically the state of Alabama, a little bit of Mississippi, and a little bit of Georgia with the Alabama and Tombigbee rivers, whereas the catchment basin for New Orleans is most, about half the country. So, sure. There's always been a difference there, but there's always been a trade between the two. And it's funny, I've had people from New Orleans come over and walk around downtown Mobile, and they see Conti and Royal and Dolphin, as we call it, Dolphin over here. Like, y'all took our street names. Actually, it was the other way around.
That's right.
So basically the same people, same team of Bienville's, founded both cities and really started it out the same way. I mean, Mobile was never the size of New Orleans when the Americans took it over. There's only about 1,500 people there compared to about 20,000 in New Orleans. And there was never as strong a Creole presence. There wasn't kind of the battle between the Creoles and the Americans that they were in New Orleans. There's definitely a Creole influence. But since the beginning, Mobile has really been more Americanized and more Southern, I'd say, when you think of Southern, sure. as opposed to New Orleans. Really, Mobile remained fairly small with the cotton boom that New Orleans had. It jumped up from about 3,000 to 30,000 by the time of the Civil War, and then stayed around 60,000 until 1930. And then with the ship production and the Air Force Base, it jumped from 70 to 200,000 between 1930 and 1960. And most of those people came from the interior of Alabama, Mississippi. And so there was definitely a stronger presence, and there is almost kind of a cultural tension between people whose culture or heritage is the Gulf Coast versus people whose heritage is more from the interior, just in terms of, evangelical denominations, Baptists. And I mean, there's one story in the 1980s of a preacher starting a war on Mardi Gras in Mobile. Luckily, it didn't go well, but it's always been a little bit more Southern, sure, than New Orleans has.
Yeah, and I think that's a good description, right? It does feel more a part of sort of the Deep South. While New Orleans is Southern, it doesn't have that feel. It doesn't have the feel of sort of once you cross into Mississippi and head along the Gulf Coast and then up a little bit there. You mentioned 1699, and that is commonly considered the first sort of celebration of Mardi Gras. And really, it was Bienville and Iberville and the expedition party stopping at a place they call Pont de Mardi Gras because it was on their calendar, Mardi Gras, Mardi Gras Day. And so by all accounts, they had a little celebration there. And that was sort of, in North America, the first sort of thing that we mark as celebrating carnival. But let's use that and jump into, let's first talk about when did carnival or Mardi Gras, and we should talk about the difference in Mobile parlance, but when did the idea of carnival start in Mobile?
So let me start by recommending some sources. I'm with the Historic Preservation Society Mobile and with the Carnival Historical Society, but really it's the primary research. There is some bad information floating around and some legends, and those are fun. But recently, there's historian Ann Pond, who's originally from New Orleans and lives in Mobile now. She got her PhD in Hattiesburg, and her thesis was on this very subject. She has three books about the early history of Mardi Gras in Mobile and New Orleans, which are excellent, and those are available online. You can get those on Amazon, so that's Ann Pond.
And we'll get it from you. We'll put it in the show notes, which will be over at beyondbourbonst.com/56.
Right. There's another academic examination of it, Samuel Kinzer's Carnival American Style, Mardi Gras in Mobile and New Orleans, which really examines more factual-based. So they kind of separate the fact from the fiction. What Mobilians would say is that in 1703, so the year after they moved from Ocean Springs area to Mobile, and there is a journal entry that mentions on Mardi Gras they had basically a feast and possibly painted their faces red with ochre. Really, and then the legend is, in 1711, there was a Society of St. Louis started, and then in 1793, there was the Spanish Mystic Society, which celebrated Twelfth Night. They had a procession on Twelfth Night. The fact that there's really not a lot of primary evidence for that. What they think happened is a fellow named Frank or Francois Diard, who was actually his family from New Orleans, but he moved to Mobile, basically created these legends in the late 1800s. And there's some others, the Bouffe Gras Society, which they uh, They had a paper mache calf, which they used the wadding during the Civil War, and that ended that society. There's a lot of interesting and kind of fun legends, but in both areas, there's really not any evidence for any societies or crews or anything like that. Now, certainly people probably had feasts. They probably celebrated. You know, most of them are Catholic. And to say it's the first, you'd have to presume they never celebrated or acknowledged it at all in French Canada, which was many, many years before French Louisiana. But that early history, there were definitely public balls the Spanish had, but nothing of what we think of Mardi Gras today, really.
Sure. And, you know, the early accounts in New Orleans, and we're going to jump into the mid to late 1800s in a minute, but there were celebrations before we think of here in New Orleans, before we think of modern Mardi Gras, modern carnival parades. There were certainly celebrations. It sounds like it was the same thing there. One of the things that interests me about Mobile is those earliest celebrations, were they all around Twelfth Night, or did some of them, they predated on the calendar into November, is that right?
Yeah, so the feast day of St. Louis is August 25th, and so that's not exactly what we would consider carnival and Mardi Gras, so that's one strike against it. Now, the Bouffe Gras Society supposedly did parade on Mardi Gras, but again, there's just not a lot of hard evidence sure. to support that contention, unfortunately.
Well, one of the things when you talk to Arthur Hardy, and again, Arthur Hardy is a local, he has a Mardi Gras guide, Arthur Hardy's Mardi Gras guide, he's a historian of Mardi Gras, really an expert. When you talk to Arthur, one of the things is that when you talk about who invented Mardi Gras, and this will be sort of a theme of the show, part of it is that certainly in Mobile, it seems like there were these celebrations that were earlier. So not Mardi Gras Day, but going back into the fall or even earlier. And so they were carnival celebrations, right? Their definition of carnival really started earlier than in New Orleans. When we think of carnival, it's Twelfth Night, January 6th forward. But there's also history to back up prior to going back in ancient times that carnival, as we think of it, those celebrations really started around the fall equinox or the autumn equinox, which would coincide sort of a little bit with the legend in the history in Mobile and before.
Yeah, right, exactly. So, and that gets to really the modern history of today's Mardi Gras and the cruise. So when that actually started was in 1831 on Christmas Eve. There was a fellow from Bristol, Pennsylvania, who had moved down to Mobile named Michael Craft. And the story is he was on a ship and was celebrating with the ship's captain and other staff, perhaps maybe celebrated a little too much, but was walked off the ship onto our Royal Street and either sat down at a hardware store and knocked over a rake and some cowbells, or had intentionally done it. In Pennsylvania, there was a tradition of mumming, which there's still mummers there.
Yeah, the mummers in Philadelphia.
Mummers there today. And so Christmas Eve, New Year's Eve, they'd go house to house singing, making a racket, what they call rough music, asking for libations and so forth. And so that was really a Pennsylvania tradition. What a lot of people don't realize, they called Mobile a colony of New Yorkers. And to some degree, it was fairly similar in New Orleans, although, like I say, there was a lot more of a Creole base there. But still, once the cotton boom started, once they became U.S. states from the 1820s on, there was a large immigration of people from New York and Pennsylvania that acted as cotton factors. So they'd take the cotton from the plantations, producers, and then market it on to be sold in New York and England. So basically, Michael Craft and his friends, most of them were from the Northeast, actually. A lot of people think the Creoles started it, and they didn't have the basis for the Mardi Gras celebration. But as far as the crews, they were really Northeasterners.
Hmm. And so the Cowbellions. So he forms the Cowbellions, and I've heard sort of it was maybe a play on some French words, but basically he's taken the idea of the cowbells and the rakes, creating a society, right?
Right. So he grabbed his cowbell and his rakes, and he grabbed some friends. They see him along the way. They start going. This basically was a pub crawl. They start going to different exchange establishments, taverns, and they start going to people's houses. And someone asks him, what society is this? Kind of a faux serious voice. He says it's the Cowbellion de Raking Society. So it was apparently such a hit that was on Christmas Eve, that they started it on New Year's Eve. They got a larger group of men to go around and basically do the same thing. The mayor invited them to their house. Really, the community kind of adopted it. And so it's amazing that basically what we know as Mardi Gras today started from a spontaneous kind of pub crawl on Christmas Eve, but that's it did. So that's where Mobile's claim really comes in. I think Mr. Hardy would agree there.
Yeah.
But the amazing thing is that they did it again the next year. This was enough of a hit that they formed this Cowbellion de Reagan Society, and it started kind of as a parody of the Masons, the Freemasons, which was big at the time. So they kind of adopted some of their mysticism in a tongue-in-cheek way. They met on what they said was Grogmore Lane, and grog is alcohol, so they met on Grogmore Lane. They had some secret codes they published in the newspaper. So that kept growing and growing. But again, what we're really talking about here is a bunch of guys going from house to house and tavern to tavern with the cowbells and rakes.
Making a ruckus.
And it's not quite clear if they were wearing masks or what they were wearing, but it was not as organized as the cruise came to be.
Sure. You know, one of the things is, as I was doing my research, it strikes me there is some similarity to that original organization, the Cowbellions, and the skull gangs, the skeletons that you see in black neighborhoods in New Orleans. And for people not familiar, these have sort of become revived today, but they are usually guys dressed up in almost like pajamas with, like, you know, the skull and bones and big, big oversized paper mache heads. And we're going to get back to the paper mache heads as we talk about the early organizations. But their job basically is to go through the neighborhood and make a ruckus, wake people up and announce, you know, it's Mardi Gras. And it seems that there's more than a passing semblance, in a sense, of that. Loosely organized, going through neighborhoods, knocking on doors, making a ruckus.
Absolutely. And, you know, I mean, even with the other marching crews that have come on today, it's kind of they harken back to the original spirit, which is, you know, just don't make it too complicated. Just get out and have fun. And that's kind of what happened to the Cowbellion. So it started out as kind of a parody of the Masons, but then they started taking their membership more and more seriously and the secrecy. And what happened is in 1840, they decided to all dress up as Greek gods and goddesses. So that was the first theme, heathen gods and goddesses. They all portrayed different gods. And basically, they'd form groups of 6 to 8 guys, about 10 groups. They had about 60 to 80 members. What they did is they had the ball afterwards. So they parade down and they'd end at the Alhambra Theater and have a ball there, which is common, what the Masons did at the time, what the what the volunteer fire companies did, what the militia did. What they started to do was, for instance, they used initials. So the second similar group to come around was called the Striker Independent Society in 1844, but they went by the initials SIS. The next group was called the TDS, and no one actually knows what that really stood for. Some say it's the Tea Drinker Society, which is probably not their real name or the determined set. But kind of like the college fraternities that were starting at the same time, or the IOOF, which is the Odd Fellows, or in New Orleans, they had what's called the SWM, or the Hepatisoffs, which were kind of these social fraternity organizations that adapted Oriental, Eastern philosophy and you know, like the Masons, they made it, you know, progressive, spiritual, and learning type thing. It's that initials, the same thing you see in college fraternities, that kind of Mobile's organizations, what we call mystic organizations, name themselves after.
Well, and a couple of things there. One, the idea of the mystic and the crew. So we're going to talk about the first carnival organizations here in New Orleans. They adopted that, and we're going to learn in just a minute how that happened. And also, as you're saying that, some of the old line carnival organizations here in New Orleans use that same thing as their logo. Their seals are really very stylized letters. And I had never thought about it in terms of, one, the tie to the Cowbellions, but also to that idea of fraternities coming around at about the same time. And so, you know, in a moment, we'll talk about Comus and Rex and Proteus, and all those old line carnival crews really started with just the stylized letters, right? You see that on the brooches and the old programs and things like that.
Yeah, so exactly. So, you know, it's that combination of fraternal societies that were common at the time, the mumming, the mummers, and then they started adapting these kind of Greek and historical themes into the parade. And then The next thing they did was they'd have tableau vivants. And so when they got to the ball, they would pose, and they'd have three or four different poses to represent a historical part of history, or again, the Greek gods. And they'd do that before the ball starts. So that's where the tableau came in.
And my understanding is that that's sort of one of the first recorded instances of using the big paper mache. Is that right? It seems like there's some mixed history there, but if you watch the meeting of the courts of Rex and Comus here in New Orleans on Mardi Gras night, the thing that sort of is shocking to people is there's this tableau right at the start by the members of Comus with these very large papier-mâché heads.
Right. So that they call that just grotesque. And that was some of the types of costumes that people used at the time. But exactly, that's Comus. The other thing you'll notice, and we're jumping ahead here.
Yeah.
But
I'm sorry.
The other thing you'll notice is if you happen to see some fellows walking from, say, Antoine's to one of the downtown hotels, and they're wearing cowbells around their neck, they're probably Comus members. I'm just going to put that out there. But they have kept a lot of those very early symbols.
So let's talk about that a little bit, since I've let the cat out of the bag, and we're trying to figure out who invented Mardi Gras, sort of, right? So you have the cowbellions. By the 1850s, they're well established. They haven't had a formal parade in the sense that we think of parades today on Mardi Gras, but they have had these organizations and these parades for quite a while.
Correct. So, yeah, at the time, all of Mobile's parades and balls are on New Year's Eve. Now, again, they did have, like many southern cities like Charleston, they had balls throughout the year, particularly in the social season, which ran from November till February or March. So they were Mardi Gras balls, but they were not any mystic societies. That's, again, where kind of our argument, I should be more like a crossfire, just not giving in here. But frankly, that's where Mobile's argument about starting Mardi Gras falls flat. I mean, there's no question everyone agrees. I think that the kind of the crew mystic society concept, as was discussed, started Mobile. So from there, and again, they put these tableaus on decorated carriages and drays or carts, and those were the first floats. So the members would be posed in the tableau vivants during the parade. Now, they weren't throwing lightsabers or cups yet,
right?
But, they were going down the street posed on these carts. So about the same time, New Orleans had more of what we think of a Mardi Gras celebration. It was not organized, and from what I see in 1837, possibly 1827, definitely 1837, were the first processions or parades. People started organized. They're not individual groups or crews. Some people would coordinate their costumes, but kind of like the French Quarter today. I mean, it's kind of a free for all. Anyone can show up. And hey, we're going to walk, rock down Charters and back down Royal, et cetera. So in the early 1850s, there actually was a New Orleans Cowbellions. They did not parade, but they threw a ball. And that lasted for about 3 years.
And those were guys that came from Mobile, right? At least in part. Or is that a little bit vague?
Again, what happened was everyone was back and forth, really.
Okay.
Most people had businesses, and sometimes they'd stay for 2 years in New Orleans, go back to Mobile.
Okay.
But the New Orleans Cowbellions, I've not seen anything about the founders there, if they're actually Mobilians or New Orleans that knew about the Cowbellions. But they called, for instance, New Orleans 1837 procession a Cowbellion.
Mm-hmm.
Paper after the first kind of Greek god tableaus in Mobile, the New Orleans paper said New Orleans should do something like this. About the same time, the New Orleans celebration started to wane in the late 1840s. Started with young men throwing flour, which was kind of a tradition, but then it got into rocks and dead cats and other sorts of things. And so the papers, according to the papers, now who knows, but Mardi Gras gone downhill.
Yeah, they were really concerned about it being public nuisance and violence and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, public nuisance, violence, and there was a concern about the future. And so, I mean, one thing Mobilians can say is if it wasn't for this influence of organizing Mardi Gras into crews, it's hard to say if it might not have died out as a public outdoor celebration
sure, sure.
as it had in other places. So in 1857, six men, three of them were Mobilians, for all intents and purposes, and the other three had ties to Alabama, met in Pope's Pharmacy and determined to form a Mobile-style mystic society, but to celebrate Mardi Gras. Mm-hmm. And that became Comus. Now, again, these are mostly Anglo-Americans, mostly some from the Northeast. You know, again, they were merchants. They were bankers. They were not. I've heard people say, well, the old lines were plantation owners. They weren't. They were basically city folk. They were merchants and bankers and that sort of thing. So when the Cowboyans had their march in 1857, they took the costumes over to New Orleans. What was called Pandemonium Unveiled for the Cowboyans became Milton's Paradise Lost, the demon actors of Milton's Paradise Lost for Comus. So they used the same costumes. For several years, the Cowboyans would come over on Mardi Gras. They'd go to the Comus Ball and even to the members-only supper after. And, you know, a lot of the Cowboyans had brothers that were in Comus, family members, that sort of thing. So they were very tight at that point.
You know, and from the beginning, so Comus is the oldest of the modern Mardi Gras carnival organizations. Comus no longer parades, but from the very beginning, there was, if you could step back in time and go in both places, you would instantly recognize the similarities. Comus is known as the Mystic Crew of Comus. They very secretive. You never know who Comus is. Incidentally, you can go around the city, and now here in January 2018, you can see the flags flying in front of someone's home. So if you see a white flag with a gold cup on it and some gold detail on it, that signifies that a member of Comus, either a king or a queen of Comus, resides at that home. And you'll see a date in the corner of that flag, but the person who is Comus is never publicly revealed. And so those kind of traditions go straight back to the Cowbellions.
Yeah, I mean, it's a direct connection. And the easiest way to kind of say it is Mobile started Mystic Society of Cruz and New Orleans moved from New Year's Eve to Mardi Gras. And, I mean, it's kind of when people ask, it's kind of like having a baby. I mean, you kind of need a mother and a father. You can't just do it with one. I mean, you have to have, you know, it took the two of them to come together and put this together, and without the two cities, the interchange between them, I mean, I don't see how we'd have Mardi Gras as we know it today.
Yeah, I think obviously you're right. The tie-in to the mummers in Philadelphia is really interesting, and of course it starts with Bienville and Iberville and the exploration and finding both places and the Pond of Mardi Gras. But then this idea, you're right. So in New Orleans, we sort of bring the idea of the societies from Mobile. We start to formalize the idea of parades and parading and all that's become on Mardi Gras Day. And so you're right, probably without the influence of the other, and now as we'll talk in a minute, as we start to move into a little bit more modern times, some of those things that New Orleans created off of that, the parades, have now circled back. And so if you go to a parade in Mobile, absolutely you can't mistake the tie-in. It looks like a Mardi Gras parade. It feels like a New Orleans Mardi Gras parade in many respects, because it's that idea of sharing those improvements, if you will, over time. So, you know, again, if we could, 1857, Comus starts not too long later, within a couple of decades. By the late 1880s, 1892, you have, here in New Orleans, you have Rex, you have Momus and Proteus, and it sort of goes from there. One of the things that was interesting to me is, in New Orleans, we associate the quote-unquote official colors of Mardi Gras as purple, green, and gold. And the story, at least, is that Rex created those when a Russian Grand Duke came to visit as a way to honor. There's some debate about that. It's interesting to me, Mobile, originally, the colors that you guys used were the purple and the gold, but not the green. Is that right? Or have I completely screwed up the history there?
No, that's right. That's completely right. And obviously, Rex's colors are, you know, which were then adapted by New Orleans, are pretty clear-cut. The selection of those colors from Mobile are not quite as clear-cut. There's not a cool story like the Grand Duke coming to visit, but they do use purple and gold. You know, I mean, really at that time, so after the Civil War, Comus starts back up, and then you have a slew of what we call the old line societies of Cruz, basically in both cities. Mm-hmm. And actually, one thing we can say now is that Mobile has the two oldest parading carnival organizations in existence. So we're, you know, it's unfortunate that Comus no longer parades, but in Mobile, the Order of Myths, what we call the 00Ms, again, going with those initials, first paraded in 1868. And then in 1869, an organization called HSS, of which the meaning was secret, started parading, and then they changed their name to the Infant Mystics, or IMs, in 1873. And both of those still parade. And again, they adopted that same formula of the parade with the theme, with the tableau, and the ball afterwards. Mm. That all O-line and most carnival organizations use these days.
Sure. One of the things that in New Orleans, again, so many of the parades, most of the parades have a king, some of them have a queen, and the king and queen of carnival is Rex. So Rex is the oldest currently parading parade. Proteus has come back, but Rex on Mardi Gras Day here in New Orleans. And so the person that is Rex, Rex means king, of course, is also considered the king of carnival. And it's interesting to me that that was an idea that was really probably adopted from Mobile, right? Because you guys have, there's one king who is considered the king of carnival or king of Mardi Gras?
Yeah, that's correct. So in 1872, Mobile had its first king. So we call our king King Felix, and he's the king of all Mardi Gras. And it was actually a fellow named Daniel Huger, H-U-G-E-R, which is an old Charleston family. But they were Mobile, but they actually moved to New Orleans. And so last year, the Queen of Rex, I forgot her first name, was a Miss Huger, and it's a direct descendant of the first. The Queen of Rex was a direct descendant of the first King Felix of Mobile. And they had a couple iterations of that. The current iteration, King Felix III, started with the current Mobile Carnival Association in 1927. And the way it works in Mobile is there's 30 or so families that started that in 1927. Most of them were in the timber business, but again, bankers and attorneys and mm-hmm. so forth. They run that, and so generally they select a young man. And initially those kings were like Rex, or they're older, kind of accomplished civic. But when they reformed it in 1927, they have a young king in his 20s now, and then also there's one queen in Mobile, again from those same families, and they have a court of maids and knights, but instead of every organization having their own king and queen, there's basically one. They're coronated on Saturday, and so for instance, when they show up at the IM ball on Lundi Gras on Monday, the IMs don't have a queen; they have a leading lady, and then they present the king and queen there, and the king and queen show up at the different balls. Another interesting difference is out of the old line crews, the IMs are the only ones that still have a ball. The 00Ms who parade on Mardi Gras night in the 1990s, they decided everyone was too tired to have a ball on Mardi Gras night, so they have a reception on Sunday afternoon. The Knights of Revelry, the KOR, who was the third oldest in 1874, they also have a daytime reception. So the only ball that of the old line is the IMs, and it's a bit different from the New Orleans balls, particularly the old line balls. Basically there's a call out, and there's a tableau, and then one dance, and then everyone gets on the floor. And I think, our, you know, we do have the, or they do have the party bands, the kind of wedding type bands, but we also have like, sure, Flow Tribe. They've had Anders Osborne. So it's a little bit more, it's become a little bit more relaxed than some of the old line.
For those of you listening that are not from New Orleans, the formal sort of tableau ball of the old line Mardi Gras organizations here in New Orleans, it's pretty neat to see the pomp and circumstance. Sometimes if you're not a member of the court or sort of the inner circle of the inner circle, there's a lot of sort of watching people go through a formal tableau and then a call out. And so there is an opportunity at some point usually to dance on the floor, but there's a lot of pomp and circumstance. And in some cases, it's almost like watching a review process. And so with all due respect to my friends that are in some of those organizations, it's not the wild, crazy party that you might see if you've been to Bacchus or Endymion and the complete blowout that's sort of open to everyone in a really sort of party atmosphere. It's a great time, but it's very much about history and tradition and celebrating the debutante season and all of that sort of thing.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, if you're interested in that sort of thing, you know, they have on YouTube, they have the meeting of the courts, you know, that are shown on PBS here. And if you're, you know, if you're interested in how these original societies do things these days, you know, they don't show everything from Comus, but they show a good bit, and so you can kind of get a feel for how it works.
It's a good point, and even as a little kid, our carnival ended in watching the meeting of the courts as long as we could stay up and watch on public television. So what happens, again, if you're not familiar, you have Rex, who's Rex is king of carnival. They still parade on Mardi Gras Day. It used to be that Comus would parade in the evening here in New Orleans. They haven't paraded since the 90s. There was an issue about opening up their membership and being public about who their members are. And when they refused to do that, then the city council said effectively, you can't parade. You're not going to get a permit. But they still have the ball in the evening. And because Comus is older, even though Rex is the king of carnival, the Rex court, the Rex king and queen proceed over. Usually it's in a hotel. These days, sometimes it's the same hotel or across Canal Street. They will parade over at the invitation of Comus, and they go and they meet the courts, and then there's a dance, and there's a whole ceremonial thing, and you can see all that on TV. Again, you don't get to see sort of the behind the scenes or who Comus is, but it is an interesting thing to sort of understand the earliest traditions of Mardi Gras here in New Orleans.
Yeah, and along those lines, there's been some recent books and films that have kind of shown a little bit behind the scenes there. One is Rosary O'Neill's book, New Orleans Carnival Cruise, and she is like Dorothy from an old line family, and she kind of details that. And then there's two films, both of which kind of show a little bit behind the scenes. New Orleans film's called By Invitation Only, and it was directed by Rebecca Snedeker. They're both a little, I'd say maybe critical of the process, but Mobiles is actually a very good film, and it deals with the whole carnival, but also that the kind of the online aspect of it is called Order of Myths, and that was on Netflix. I know you can still stream it online. Kind of, if you're interested in the kind of the sociology and you know, of carnival, those both kind of open the curtains a little bit.
And I'll get some of that from you, and we'll put it again over in the show notes at beyondbourbonst.com/56. Let's jump forward a little bit and talk about modern parade season, modern parades in Mobile. If we were to go over to Mobile this season and want to experience some Mardi Gras parades, what would it look like?
So in general, the everything's fairly similar to New Orleans. One of the main differences is that Mobile has barricades, but they don't have ladder chairs, and they don't have necessarily people with tents and that sort of thing laid out. So it's kind of good and bad. There are a few ladder chairs here or there, but it's really, you walk up and down the street, everything's kind of free moving. I mean, as a, you know, parent of a young son, I appreciated the barricades at the time, but you know, there it's a drawback to them. And so, you know, in last couple of years, I've brought my son over here just so he could see what the parades are like, you know, without barricades.
Sure. So what Ted's talking about, if you haven't been to Mardi Gras here in New Orleans, is that for most part along the parade route in uptown New Orleans, you can go right up to the floats. So you can interact directly with the riders. You can touch the float. The downside, of course, is a safety issue. They're pulling these massive floats that weigh thousands of pounds, and they're being pulled by big tractors. Well, kids and adults can get caught under those floats. So there is a real danger that you got to pay attention to. The advantage, of course, of the barricades is it keeps you removed. In some way, it takes away that direct interaction just a bit. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's. I don't know. I guess growing up in New Orleans, you get used to it and you learn quickly. And I mean, but there's potential. You know, there's always potential for, unfortunately, for a serious incident. But those happen in Mobile as well.
Sure.
But that's one of the main differences. I'd say from the Mobile standpoint, one thing you notice is Mobile people give New Orleans grief about essentially what happens just in the French Quarter. So kind of the wild. And a lot of them have never been to the St. Charles area, and so they don't get. So Mobile says we're family friendly, but really, if you go to St. Charles, it's of course family right. friendly as well. And other than the barricades, they look fairly similar. They throw the same things. Now, Mobile will start its parades this weekend, so we're
okay.
3 weekends before
sure,
Mardi Gras. And of course, New Orleans has the Crew de Vue, which is a marching society
right.
in the French Quarter, but we start our full parades this weekend. And these are some of the newer crews, and they'll often bunch three of them together. They're getting started, so it doesn't have the it's not Bacchus or Endymion, you know, but it's a good time. There's probably about 20 units, you know,
okay.
And then you add on, you know, if they put three together, 30 units. So,
but you know, that's an important, so again, yeah, we're 3 weeks out from, we're 20 days out from Mardi Gras as we record this. And so you got a couple of weekends here. Here in New Orleans, parades start 12 days before Mardi Gras, essentially. So the Friday or Saturday before the weekend before Mardi Gras. Whereas you guys start earlier, and that makes a big difference. But like that first weekend of Mardi Gras here in New Orleans, the parades aren't quite as elaborate. They're great, and they're particularly fun for families. So we usually take our kids out the first weekend. It's just not as crazy as some of the super crews here in New Orleans. But it sounds like it's the same thing, but even more so because you get to start a week earlier.
Yeah, so it is. You know, it's kind of... like, I guess one thing that Mobile and New Orleans have is we've got dozens of crews. I mean, if you go to, you know, some of the other cities on the Gulf Coast, they'll have, you know, a couple crews the weekend of. Mm-hmm. But really, I don't know if a lot of New Orleans realize that, like, Mobile's, we've got dozens and dozens of crews.
Yeah.
But so we'll start this weekend. And another difference is that basically most Mobile crews use one route, and there's advantages and disadvantages to that. The two oldest crews, the IMs and WMs, start from their dens, so a little bit different. And some of the historically African American crews go down through that main commercial area, kind of take a detour. So, but basically there's one route, which is both good and bad. I mean, again, you pick your spot, you know, you're there, you can see every parade.
Sure.
You know, whereas New Orleans, you got some out in Metairie, some on the West Bank. One thing I wish Mobile did have more of is kind of the newer invention, which are the, you know, marching crews in the French Quarter and the Bywater and the Marigny, and just, you know, kind of more out in the neighborhoods.
Sure. You know, if I could pick that apart a little bit, Ted. So one of the interesting things there is, right, Mobile has had a standard route, if you will, for the most part, for a longer period of time than New Orleans. But particularly post-Katrina, one of the things that's happened in New Orleans is many, many of the parades have consolidated onto a primary route in uptown New Orleans. And there's been some consternation about that. I think that New Orleans followed the lead of Mobile in the sense of it's easier for the police to manage if you don't have these multiple routes. And there's always a concern about emergencies and how do emergency responders move around a city that where they sort of get stuck in all these routes. But along with that comes this loss of sort of, there were always neighborhood parades. So here in New Orleans, all throughout, I grew up in Gentilly and there was Hercules, right? And in Carrollton, there was Carrollton in Mid-City. And so the parades were all over the city. And so it kind of, we're a collection of neighborhoods here in New Orleans. And so every neighborhood had their own organizations. And to some degree, as we've consolidated onto fewer and fewer routes, you lose some of that. But that's where I'll take you back to where you were headed with the, I think this outgrowth or explosion of marching crews has started to help various parts of the community sort of redefine themselves in that way.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, it is due to our first responders and our police, and it's, you know, it's understandable, and having method to the madness, and, you know, and the barricades all set up, particularly in our case. But yeah, you do. I remember seeing a map of the Mardi Gras routes in the 1980s in New Orleans, and they were all over the place.
Yeah.
There were dozens of them, and I remember I told you growing up on Versailles Boulevard, just down from the two lane. I walked two blocks from my house, and John Candy was there as the King of Tux, and I got his autograph and chatted with him. So, you know, there's not a lot of places now in Mobile where you can walk two blocks and go to a parade.
Sure, sure. You know, the other thing, though, is so post-Katrina, again, we kind of mentioned it, the walking crews in New Orleans have exploded. And really, a lot of that can be traced to when the Saints won the Super Bowl, the forerunner of what is now the 610 Stompers, a hugely popular men's marching group in the city. And you sort of have to look it up. We'll put a link to describe it. But it's basically not always young men, not always in the best physical shape, wearing these satin light blue jogging shorts, sort of if you think of the 80s, and the tube socks and red jackets. And they sort of parody the female marching crews that we had for years, particularly like in would march behind bands in parades. And they're hysterical and they're very, very popular. And so off of that has spawned all these different organizations. So there's the Pussyfooters and there's the Muffalatas and there's lots of them, some of them with inappropriate names, but there's the Rolling Elvi. So guys dressed up as Elvis in motorized lazy boys, basically. And I think that has been a sense of kind of bringing back individual perspective and personas. But to me, it kind of ties back to the Cowbellian society, if you think about it, and the earliest days of sort of these loose-knit groups or societies marching, right? Not with the carnival parades and floats that we see today, but this sort of loose bonding together, whether it was religion or business or whatever it was. And in some sense, I think that's come full circle.
Yeah, and it has. And I mean, New Orleans had a kind of an influx of people from across the country after Katrina, which I think is great. I mean, it's interesting. And they've kind of used Mardi Gras in some sense to integrate themselves and adapt. And I think some will give the old line crews a little bit of grief. And maybe there's been some back recently with the satirical crews. But that's kind of how Carnival kind of, you know, you get everyone together, and I think it's good. I mean, a lot of cities, you never get everyone together, even if there's some hopefully playful tension there. But the people that have moved from other areas have found ways to integrate themselves. And so that's part of that. Those marching crews is part of that continual reinvention and intervention in Carnival. And one thing I haven't mentioned in Mobile that is kind of special is Joe Kane Day. If you I'll talk about that for a minute if you want.
Absolutely.
Kind of same thing. So you had the very formal OOMs, kind of the Comus equivalent, you know, starting 1868. Same day, Joe Kane was a clerk in the city market. He was in a fire company. He went to New Orleans in 1867. The fire company parade was the day before Mardi Gras. So he paraded, and then he saw Mardi Gras the next day. And so he determined, I'm going to bring, you know, Mardi Gras parade to Mobile from New Orleans. And he had about the same time as the OOMs, but so he got some buddies, and they dressed up as different animals, dogs and cats and so forth. And they jumped on a wagon and made this rough music. So they were kind of parodying the OOMs. They paraded right before the OOMs. And they did that for about 15 years, and then Joe Kane died, and they kind of their parody group kind of fell apart. But in 1967, a local folklorist and personality named Judy Rayford decided that we need to recognize the founder, what essentially was the founder of Mobile Mardi Gras.
Sure.
So he was buried in Bayou La Batterie, which is right on the coast. They dug him up. They moved him to the downtown cemetery, the Church Street Graveyard in Mobile. And they held a jazz funeral with him. The legend says he had Joe Kane's skull in his pocket during the jazz funeral. We don't know about that. But they did that again the next year, and 1968 now. There were more people. They started having parties in the graveyard. By 1977, they had over 200 decorated vehicles and thousands of people. And basically, they'd start the parade, and they had to stop because the front would reach, the tail hadn't even started by the time the front. So imagine like a parade going on the French Quarter,
right,
and you hadn't even started moving the back part yet, and you'd run into itself. So, and that they call that the People's Parade.
Okay.
So we do that now on the Sunday before. They had to limit the marchers. They limited it for years and years. They've just reopened that this year. In the 1970s, they were having these Joe Kane's Merry Widows. So women all dressed in black, supposedly had 10 widows. And then following them were Joe Kane's mistresses. So they're dressed in all red. They were kind of almost the same thing as, say, the Pussyfooters and so forth, kind of antecedents and that. And then you had the Society of Bums dressed as bums. So in the 1970s, really kind of Mobile again, you get back to that original spirit, you know, of the Cowbellions with the Joe Kane procession.
Yeah.
Every time someone gets a little bit too formal, then someone else makes fun of them. And then that starts kind of a people's parade.
I'm glad you mentioned Joe Kane because, again, there's so many similarities, and we'll get back to, again, some closing arguments, if you will, about who invented Mardi Gras. But as I first learned about Joe Kane, it struck me what you just said, that Carnival in both places has this history of it gets real formal and then someone decides to poke fun at it, and it's sort of this cycle repeats. And in New Orleans, of course, Zulu in the early 1900s was very much, this was and still is a crew run by African Americans. They were very much excluded from society and excluded from any of the sort of formal Mardi Gras that we're talking about. And so they formed Zulu, and Zulu is intentionally trying to mock Rex. So for all the formality of Rex, who's dressed like a king and wears a crown and has a scepter, Zulu had an oil can or a coffee can for a hat, and used a banana stalk as a scepter, and dressed in blackface. And so it was this very much trying to parody that. And you see those same things repeated in both Mobile and New Orleans. And even today, as you said, a lot of the walking groups sort of parody the more formal things. And that just keeps going and going and going across both. And it's hard to say where it came from first, but I do think it's one of the similarities. The two cities tend to say, oh, we're very different, or we own this, or we own that. But there's so much overlap back and forth, and it continues.
Yeah, I mean, you can't stop it, the back and forth. Well, you mentioned Zulu. So in Pritchard, there was a man that would parade his goat every Mardi Gras. And so eventually, after several years, became the Goat Man Parade. And now, like, it's a big thing. And, like, people go there from the, the fanciest parts of, Mobile. And it's just, it started spontaneously. But, yeah, so Rex threw a doubloon in 1960. The IMs threw him in 1965. Mm-hmm. You know, so you got the Moon Pies, you know.
Oh, we didn't even mention Moon Pies.
Of course.
So let's talk about Moon Pies.
So they outlawed Cracker Jack boxes in Mobile. So they started throwing Moon Pies. And so, now we drop this big electric Moon Pie at the beginning of every parade that we also drop on New Year's Eve. And now that Moon Pie is such a big thing, you know, it's kind of funny seeing people notice it. But
Pies are sort of one of the signature throws of parades in Mobile.
Correct, right. And so I've seen a couple people throw them here. It's so they started that in Mobile by outlawing Cracker Jack boxes, you know. But yeah, we recently, people said, well, we can't say Les a la Bon Temps Brulee, because that's Cajun French, and that came from, you know, Lafayette or somewhere, and we didn't invent it, but so we're going to use another. And no, I mean, just, you know, you can't stop this.
Right.
You can't stop this back
this
and forth.
It's ridiculous.
So there's no way. I mean, people see it, a good idea. I mean, that's why it's always evolving into culture. I mean, so really, and you mentioned Richard Campanella, and I mean, if you have any interest in New Orleans or just cities in general, I mean, I'd read everything everything he does. And it's great to see him come over to Mobile, and he starts taking pictures of the same architecture and stuff. But
right. He recently spent a weekend there with his family and did a lot online. So we're talking about Richard Campanella. He's been a guest on this show three times. The book we most recently talked about was Bienville's Dilemma. You can follow him on Twitter at Nola Campanella. And again, we'll put a link there. But you're right. He does a great job of sort of, when you follow his feed and you looked at that weekend he spent in Mobile recently, you could, if he didn't tell you it was Mobile, in many cases you would think, oh gosh, that looks like the French Quarter.
Yeah, and so one thing he kind of talks about is, it's funny, and I'm totally guilty of it, is New Orleans exceptionalism. And to be honest with you, until I met my wife, I hadn't been to Mobile like everyone else. I drove through it, and then, but you know, if you go to Ocean Springs or Pensacola or Mobile, you realize, hey, well, they cook crawfish, you know, they boil crawfish too, you know, they, you know, cook gumbo too. They started the West Indies salad over here. I mean, you know, just, it's really, there's a Gulf Coast culture. And
sure.
I mean, that's one thing that, having lived in both places, that, you know, that's why I'm here today. I mean, just because we really need to try and preserve that what's a Gulf Coast culture, you know,
yeah,
I would call it.
You know, and maybe we'll do a separate episode outside of Mardi Gras and talk about Mobile as sort of an adventure beyond Bourbon Street, if you will, a weekend getaway from New Orleans. I did have two questions about Mardi Gras and Mobile in terms of compared to New Orleans. One, is it as common that the families dress in mask on Mardi Gras Day, or is that less so there in Mobile?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. It used to be. I mean, there's pictures and everyone's dressed up. I'd say it's actually more common on Joe Kane Day. Joe Kane Day is just very relaxed. Everyone goes down and everyone participates. Now, the police limited that some, but we're getting back into it. Like, again, my wife, when she was six, you know, put on, you know, costume, face paint, and roller skated.
And participated.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's one of the good things. And that is, kids could jump in and participate as well. So actually, it's more common on Joe Kane Day. Some people do it on Mardi Gras Day, but not as commonly as in New Orleans.
And then the other thing that someone will ask me certainly is, obviously in New Orleans, we have open containers and alcohol is prevalent along the routes. Is it the same in Mobile, or is it a little bit tighter there?
Well, so, you know, occasionally Mobile has to fight Montgomery for permission to do certain things that we would take for granted here. But no, we have an entertainment district downtown, and you're supposed to have it in plastic cups and that sort of thing. But no, it's as long as you, you know, although they have bigger fish to fry at the time. But yeah, if you use common sense, it's legal. So
yeah. So again, as we start to wrap, I think that, you know, the what we started with is, who invented Mardi Gras? I think it sort of comes down to, well, what do you define as Mardi Gras, right? Carnival celebrations in the broad sense almost certainly in Mobile predated New Orleans, you know, particularly those early things. When you start to talk about, if you define Mardi Gras as Mardi Gras Day, well, then New Orleans probably has the leg up and was the first to do that. But there's so many things back and forth that this is why Ted and I thought this would be a fun topic.
Yeah, I mean, you don't have to know all the history to just go and catch some bees.
Absolutely.
And, you know, have a good time. But, you know, if you think about, okay, why does this crew do this? I mean, who are these people walking through the French Quarter with cowbells around their neck? I mean, you know, if you're, you know, I think it's important for golf coasters to know this stuff. But, I mean, if you're a visitor, if you know the history behind it and then you see, oh, okay, that's why they do that. I think it's worthwhile to know, and I don't think we're going to change anybody's mind. I think Mobile is going to say 1703, you know, we were first. New Orleans will say Nokomis, 1857, you know. But like I say, it's fun. It's kind of like, you know, SEC football. As long as you don't get, you know, as long as you get too upset about it, you know, it's hopefully a friendly.
Sure.
Friendly rivalry.
You know what I love about the discussion, again, much like Richard Campanella, what Richard does is allow you to see the city and see the history through these different layers. And hopefully this discussion has helped the listeners to think about that. So when you see things on the parade route or on television, if you're not fortunate enough to be here, you think, oh, that's interesting. That's a detail that I would have never thought about. And now I get it. So I really appreciate it. This has been a fun time, Ted, going back through Mardi Gras history in both places. Thank you for doing this.
I know. Thank you. And, you know, again, I think everyone should do both, and I think everyone should have a good time, and I don't think we're going to stop the rivalry.
No, so. We're probably not, certainly if you live in one of the two cities. But if you don't, I think maybe you can approach it a little more objectively. And, you know, this whole discussion feels like just such a nice tie-in to New Orleans at 300 and the tricentennial, and so much about New Orleans is based upon other cultures coming here and blending in and going back and forth. So I really appreciate it. Thanks to Ted again for joining us. A special thanks to Liz Marty Cook here at Lionheart Prints. Please come check them out, y'all. I think Liz and I are going to do a Beyond Bourbon Street / Lionheart Prince pint night at the Bulldog, which is right down the street from here after Mardi Gras. Again, you can find the notes for today's episode at beyondbourbonst.com/56. And by the way, if you want help planning your trip to New Orleans, don't forget about our paid travel consult service. It can really help when you want to get into the details and maximize your time. Find out more over at beyondbourbonst.com/travel. If you want to hear more shows like this one, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. And we're now on Spotify, too. New episodes are available every other Wednesday. If you're enjoying the show, please share it with someone else who loves New Orleans as much as you and me. Until next time, laissez les bâtons rouler.
Thanks for listening to the Beyond Bourbon Street podcast. Find us anytime at beyondbourbonst.com.